Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
You're listening to Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, sitting in today for host Carrie Miller. The Writers Guild of America is now in its sixth week of striking. And after last week's breakdown in negotiations, there's no immediate end in sight. It's clashing with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, or AMPTP, over compensation based on DVD sales and internet downloads. With writers on strike, the amount of new material coming out of the entertainment industry is dwindling. David Letterman and Jay Leno are playing reruns. Many TV series will have no new episodes to offer within the next few weeks, and productions of several motion pictures have stalled. Some analysts worry the strike is having a detrimental effect on the entertainment industry, with a particularly negative impact on the Los Angeles economy. Today, we're going to talk about the writer's strike, its impact on the industry, and how it's affecting your TV viewing habits. Joining us this hour is Renee Balsay, Emmy Award-winning writer and producer of the TV series Law and Order. He's also the executive producer and head writer for Law and Order Criminal Intent. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Also joining us is Jerry Nicholsberg, a professor of economics with the UCLA Anderson Forecast. Welcome, Jerry Nicholsberg.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We should also note that we did put a request out to the AMPTP to join our conversation representing the producer's point of view, and they did decline. So we're going to go on this conversation anyway. And Renee, I should say that you are not only a writer, but you are a producer. Are you striking against yourself?
I pick it outside my own office half an hour every day. No, I have one foot in both camps, but sort of nine of my toes are in the writer's camp. Whatever success I've had as a producer is only due to the writing. And, I've refused to cross a picket line. So I have not been working for 6 weeks. So.
And how has that affected your job and your career in terms of, the impact on your work immediately?
Certainly, I have a lot more time on my hands. That's the first thing. No more deadlines, at least until the strike's over. It's the impact on my career. It will be minimal. The strike isn't really about people like me. It's really about the average writer who makes about $62,000 a year. This is really an attack on the middle class by huge multinational media conglomerates. So for me, I'm kind of paying homage to the people in the Writers Guild who preceded me and who went on strike in the early 60s to get us residuals and health and pension benefits, and they went on strike for 6 months in 1960. For me, this is more about that, and it's about winning or certainly preserving what we have for writers in the future. It's not about me.
Right. How do you think the strike is going overall? What do you sense from the other writers who are sort of on the lower end of the totem pole?
I think the strike is going pretty much as, those of us who've been through other strikes, have predicted. It takes a while for the impact of us going out on strike to be felt by certainly the community in Los Angeles. It's not like we're an essential service, or it's not like we're bus drivers and immediately everybody has to walk to work. So mm-hmm. There's a certain lag time. Usually the first 2 or 3 months of these kinds of strikes are taken up by a lot of posturing, and the AMPTP believes it can win this strike through attrition and waiting us out and sowing division and walking out of negotiations and refusing to negotiate. So it's going pretty much as predicted.
Hmm. And do you have any hopes at this point that the Writers Union can come to an agreement with the Producers Association?
We have not left the bargaining table. They have left the bargaining table now twice in a huff. They're having hissy fits every 3 weeks. They have not engaged us in good faith negotiations at all. They, like I said, their tactics are about stalling and trying to divide the Guild. They think it worked in 1988. They think it'll work again. So, I wouldn't predict anything dramatic is going to happen until sometime in mid-January.
Jerry Nicholsberg, you actually argue that predictions of a $1 billion economic loss for the entertainment industry is grossly overcalculated. Could you talk a little bit about how you see this impacting the industry and the surrounding economy?
Sure. I think, Rene said it well, when he said it takes a while for this to work out. One of the reasons why there's a lot of attention paid to the writer's strike is that it affects entertainment that comes into all of our homes. And so when, the subsequent episodes of Desperate Housewives or 24 are threatened, then, we all kind of pay attention. But this is a fairly unremarkable labor action or labor negotiations. It looks like many others. And typically when a strike such as this occurs, people look at the wages that would have been paid in a normal normal month and then gross those up to the number of months that they expect the strike to happen, as well as all of the collateral impact. But, of course, strikes are predictable events, and people prepare for them. And as Rene correctly pointed out, everyone prepared for this. There was stockpiling of shows to be sold during the early part of the strike on the part of the producers with the hope that, they could sell those during the early part of the strike and mitigate the economic damage that and economic pain that the other side wished them to feel. And conversely, on the writer's strike, writer's side and the side of all the others who are affected by the strike, the non-producers, they put together strike funds in order to try and mitigate the economic damage. And so one has to look at the changed behavior before, during, and after the strike and net those that additional work that was done before and will be done afterwards in terms of the overall economy. Now, that doesn't mean that that the individuals involved don't feel economic pain. That's really the purpose of a strike, is to inflict economic pain on the other side to move them towards your side. But in terms of the overall Los Angeles economy, that really mitigates a lot of the impact. And then the second important point, which is particularly important at this juncture, is that consumers of scripted television, for example, are not just going to sit there and watch reruns if they have alternatives that that are better options for them. And, part of this strike is about how does one divide up the profits of Internet sales and so on. That's a new technology. And there are lots of avenues for substitution to interactive video games, which are produced in Los Angeles and are now expanding rapidly to webisodes, to all kinds of other
right.
entertainment. And the longer the strike goes on, the more substitution away from the types of shows that are being struck will occur. So that will expand some parts of the Los Angeles economy and contract others. And so, you know, when you do the accounting properly and net these out, you don't come up with huge numbers. It's a strike that lasts into April for the Los Angeles economy as a whole, not for the, the strikers and the producers and so on in particular, but for the Los Angeles economy as a whole, it's only at most 0.1% of the LA economy. So that's not a, that's a very modest number.
Rene Balsay, Jerry Nicholsberg just touched on this briefly about the motivations behind the strike, but let's go and do a little bit more background. How long has this been in the works, and what is the frustration that led to the strike, the writer's strike in the first place?
Well, supposedly we've been in negotiations since July. I mean, again, the AMPTP has been sort of playing sort of keep away with us for the last 6 months and not wanting to negotiate and then not offering proposals or counter proposals to our pattern of demand. So I think it's been in the works for the last year. The Writers Guild has been telling the producers that we're serious. The AMPTP has not focused on this until basically, November 3rd of this year, basically, you know, the 2 days after the contract expired and 1 day before we had called to have a strike. So, you know, so this has been a long time coming. The frustration comes, at least on the writer side, is we feel that, you know, 20 years ago we gave away a video cassette and DVD residuals. You know, we gave the producers a pretty sweet deal. And again, that was at a time when the producers told us, "Well, we don't know what DVDs are going to be. It's a new technology. Let's not settle on any numbers right now. Let's study the sales and development of DVDs." And we foolishly agreed to that. We trusted them. And then, as DVDs took off, we tried to revisit this in subsequent negotiations over the last 15-20 years, and they refused. They said, "You made a deal in 1988, you're going to have to live with it." So this time we're not going to take sandbagging from the AMPTP. They keep telling us the internet is developing, it's too early to tell what the business model will be. And, they want to study it for another 3 years. Well, 3 years from now, it'll be too late. The business model is being established right now. Google, through YouTube, just made a deal with its content providers that they will share advertising revenues on YouTube with the people who provide content to YouTube. So that's a new business model. We are not going to wait. We certainly don't want to wait another 3 years before we make a deal on revenues from the internet. You know, now is the time.
We're talking this hour on Mid-Morning about the writer's strike that's affecting the Hollywood television and movie industry. It's now in its sixth week, and there's been a breakdown in negotiations. No immediate end in sight. We'd love to hear from our listeners this hour. Are you a member of the Writers Guild of America? Is this affecting you? Or is it affecting your TV viewing habits? Have you found that you're not liking what you're finding? There's no fresh content for you? Are you holding out just fine? This doesn't seem to affect your life at all. Give us a call, 1-800-242-2888. Or in the metro area, you can reach us at 651-227-6000 or go to minnesotapublicradio.org and click on send a question. We've got a call from Alan. He's on the line from Watertown. Alan, welcome to Mid Morning. What's your comment or question?
Hi, thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
I actually think it's going to cripple and maybe destroy Hollywood in a way. The reason that big advertisers advertise on ABC, NBC, and CBS and Fox is because they have a lock on the market. If they didn't have a lock on the market, they wouldn't. And what they're finding out is when they go to the internet, it's, you know, an equalizer. So they used to be a big TV station because they had a lock, but that was the only reason. The programming isn't that good. If you go to the internet now, there's literally, you know, tens of thousands of serial TV shows that are on the internet. And why would people go back to, you know, the three or four choices? They won't eventually. You know, TV's just, it'll be gone in 5 years.
All right, Alan, thanks for your comment. Jerry Nicholsberg, do you think that this is the beginning of a new era of delivery systems where it's going to just change the industry and the money we pay for the product and how the jobs work?
Well, the industry is changing. The strike notwithstanding, that change is going to occur, and everyone knows that the changes that have occurred in the music industry were just a precursor to this. And the only question is the timing. The longer the strike goes on, the less the content of these kinds of programs will be fresh in people's houses, and the more incentive they'll have to go and check out the new technology. So this may speed the transformation of the industry. Will it wreck Hollywood? Well, you know, one has to look at how large a portion of the entertainment industry this particular type of programming is. It's not all of Hollywood, to be sure. This is one segment of the television industry. But that's changing, and we're only talking about the rapidity of change. But to be sure, that kind of change is going to occur.
Rene Ball say that John Paul in Woodbury writes, is there any sympathy for the producer's position? Will their lives or jobs be significantly impacted if the writers get the rights they are demanding?
No. Well, I'll give you an example. You know, but I certainly feel bad for this gentleman. Les Moonves, the head of CBS yesterday, finalized his new contract. It's a 3-year contract that will pay him $50 million a year. So I really feel, I'm sure it's going to be a pretty glum Christmas at the holidays at the Moonves house this year.
How would it affect you, though? You're a producer.
Like I said, the strike's not about people like me. I've been incredibly lucky, you know, over the last few years to be associated with the shows that are, you know, have a long life. So for the average writer, it's not going to be necessarily a happy time, but I think most of the writers knew what they were doing when they authorized the strike. They knew what they were into, that it wasn't going to be a 2-week romp of chanting and around the studios.
I guess I'm thinking from the producer point of view. Would it impact you in any way as a producer of the show? Because you're also a producer and a writer.
Well, I'm not going to be producing anything, so you know, I'll be writing my great American novel, and you know, income-wise, it's not going to make a difference to me. Like I said, it's not. You know, I've got, you know, guns, lawyers, and money, so I'll be okay. Jerry's you know, was making a good point as far as, you know, the strike may hasten the move to other forms of entertainment. And your previous caller, Alan, you know, was talking about the internet and people are going to be seeking entertainment on the internet. Well, within 5 or 10 years, you know, the broadcast networks may be out of business. You won't necessarily be getting your television shows, you know, through your satellite dishes or your cable box, and they're not going to be necessarily delivering reels of film to movie theaters. Everything will be streamed over the internet. And your television will be plugged into your computer. The movie screen at the theater will be plugged into some kind of computer system, and everything will be streamed over the internet. So, and that's one of the reasons why this strike is very important, not only to writers but to everybody in Hollywood who gets the benefits of a form of deferred compensation called residuals. That everything will be going over the internet, and the producers will then be able to label all the content that we create for them as internet-based content. And they will, you know, if they get what they want, they will be able to avoid paying this deferred compensation to writers, actors, directors, members of the Teamsters and IATSE, you know, middle-class people who depend on residuals to fund their health and pension plans, to pay mortgages, to pay doctor bills, and all sorts of things. So,
yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Dave on the line in Eden Prairie. Dave, welcome to Mid Morning.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't understand the inner workings of that industry, but speaking from a consumer's point of view, I'm middle-aged and I'm hardly a prude, but I find the broadcast shows, sitcoms and dramas, so vulgar that I don't care to watch them anymore. In fact, I've been shopping for old TV shows in the stores, and I'm collecting them and enjoying them, and I'm seeing a vast dramatic difference between the quality of the writing in the old shows versus what's being pumped out today. So I think the writers, unfortunately for themselves, are going to have a hard time whipping up any sympathy from the average public.
Because you don't think the quality of the writing is that good in the first place.
It's not the quality of the writing. It's the vulgarity and the violence.
Okay.
And I'm a middle-aged male, and I can take a lot. But when I turn on the TV, I want to be uplifted.
Right.
I'm constantly barraged with murders, sex offenders, basically vulgar themes, even in the sitcoms. And I'm aghast. I can hardly believe that they can even show that stuff.
All right, Dave. Thanks for your comment.
Well, I would
Rene Ball say I should mention.
I would
remind people.
Tell Dave to direct his anger at the studios and the studio executives who give notes to writers and who only buy certain concepts and ideas from writers if they have what they call edge. You know, they want edgy material. So. It's not necessarily, you know, the writers who dictate what gets on television. It's the studio executives and the network executives who are the buyers, and they're the ones who buy the concepts and buy the, you know, the series, and who, you know, give you notes. You know, they note you to death, and they say, well, this isn't edgy enough. Well, could you, you know, do this, do that? Could we get a little more of this, a little more of that? They're the ones, you know, who are, they're the buyers, so they call the tune. So, if, you know, if you don't like what you see on television, it's not the writers, it's the studios, it's the networks, it's the producers who are, you know, calling the shots.
Come on now, Renee, though. Renee, I have to say, though, I mean, so do you sitting there writing Law & Order Criminal Intent ever feel pangs of guilt for the content that you're putting out there?
Pangs of guilt?
Yeah, in terms of the violence and the things that you are...
Well, on Law & Order, there's not much violence. I mean, there's allusions to murders, but I don't think we've ever shown anything on screen. It's, you know, it's a pretty tame show compared to, you know, other fare that's available out there.
True. It's more talking about it than actually showing it.
Yeah.
That's, okay. Jerry, I heard you wanting to make a comment there.
Yes. Renee, isn't it true that the real buyers of the shows are the advertisers, that they are the ones who are footing the bill, and the amount that they pay depends on the amount of viewership per show?
Well, that's true.
That's
true, because in a way we're kind of a delivery system for eyeballs for, you know, to advertisers.
Right.
You know, they get to choose among whatever the networks are offering. And ultimately, you know, the ultimate buyer is the consumer. The, you know, if you don't like what you're seeing, you just turn off the television, and suddenly, you know, there's no audience for that show. And certainly, the advertisers will, you know, not advertise on a show that no one's watching. So
unfortunately, the fact is that a lot of people are watching those shows with violence or, you know, obscene content that our friend was saying turns them off.
It's a question of, you know, it's a chicken or the egg. I mean, are they watching this because they got nothing else to watch and that's all there is to watch? Or are they watching, or is their viewing preferences dictating what's, you know, being produced in Hollywood? You know, it's kind of a, like I said, a chicken or the egg kind of argument.
Let's go to John in Newmarket. John, welcome to Mid-Morning. What's your comment or question?
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to comment that in August of 2005, the mechanics at a major airline here in the United States, we all went on strike. Quite a few of us ended up losing our jobs. I actually got married 3 weeks into the strike, so I'd just like to say, really, hold strong. Support that line, and if you could please talk to some of the members that are feeling pressured across, you got to convince them not to do it, because once they put themselves in that lifestyle, they never come out of it, and they'll regret it. And when they do go back in, it's not the same until you all go back together. Lastly, bargaining in good faith, you commented on it earlier, and that's a requirement of the people you're trying to negotiate with to do it. So they're just showing their lack of character. And just trying to bust you. The middle class is hurting enough, so they don't need to do that. I really support what you're doing and hope that you can hold the line.
All right, John.
Well, thank you, John.
Yep. Thanks, John, for your comment. Any remarks to that, Renee? And in terms of, do you think, John, you know, is working for an airline as a mechanic, and some people would say that there's an immediate need for his work more so than a TV writer. I'm wondering if you feel like support like his is a little rare simply because of the nature of the work.
I don't think the support, I understand the difference, and in terms of what John does and the immediate impact of his, you know, denying his services. But I think it's not rare to hear this kind of support, because, like as I said, it's, you know, we're up against six multinational conglomerates, and they're no different than United Airlines or American Airlines. You know, they're driven by the same dynamics, and, you know, they are, you know, out to crush unions. They're you know, delivering an attack on the middle class, and I think every union member and every working person can sympathize with that. You know, we're kind of, we have this, you know, sort of glamorous appearance because of, you know, the business we're involved in. But, you know, we're, like I said, we're, you know, the average writer makes $62,000 a year. We're kind of workaday people. You know, on my staff, going into this strike, I had one writer whose wife was delivered like three days after the beginning of the strike. I had another writer who's, you know, 4 months pregnant. So, and you know, these are not people with, you know, trust funds or anything like that. They're, you know, they're just working folk like everybody else. So in LA, we're getting support from Teamsters. Yesterday, there was a truck that was delivering beer to a studio party, and we stopped the truck. It was a Teamster driver. It was explained that the local Teamster had allowed individual members to honor our picket line. The Teamster driver, you know, sat for about half an hour, called his local, turned his truck around. So, you know, the studio producer's party, you know, had no beer that day. So we're getting a lot of, you know, sort of grassroots support. So,
okay.
And, you know, John, John's support is we've been hearing a lot of that, and we really appreciate it.
Jerry Nicholsberg, I know we've only got you for a couple more minutes here. I'm wondering, you're summing up your opinions on where you think this is going to head for financially for these people who are, you know, affected by the strike. If we don't see a larger economic impact, are we going to see sort of a trickle-down effect coming from the writers are dealing with in terms of being on strike and not working?
Well, I think one has to distinguish between the economic impact on those directly involved in the strike and the economic impact on the greater Los Angeles economy.
Mm-hmm.
Those involved in the strike, it's very real, and you've heard anecdotal evidence to that on the show this morning. It's real. It impacts them. There is economic pain involved. But I think that one can look at another local strike that we had here that, because it did not affect consumers in Minnesota, you may not have heard about, which was our grocery clerks strike, which went on for a long time and was a very difficult labor negotiation. But what, you know, one of the things that happened was that people did not stop buying groceries. They simply went to other providers. They went to Costco and Walmart and to Whole Foods and so on. And at the end of that, a number of them did not come back to the more traditional grocery stores. So what happened was that those new providers expanded and hired people, and the older providers contracted. And I think the gentleman who was commenting on the airline strike saying that some people lost their jobs permanently, individually, this is difficult for those directly involved, and if that segment of the entertainment industry contracts, there will be fewer jobs there. But overall, to the Los Angeles economy, although there is an impact, it's not a huge impact. This is, the entire entertainment industry in Los Angeles is about 6.5% of our income. We're a very diversified economy here.
Yeah. I just wonder if this points to an ongoing problem with weakness of unions and their efficacy in terms of getting things for their members.
We've seen that in labor negotiations across the country. I don't know if so much you would call it weakness of unions as, kind of a recognition that the world has changed very substantially, that we're much more integrated internationally. And so new models are being constructed as to how to put together labor relations. And, Renee was referring to that in the entertainment industry. That's changing dramatically. New business models are coming up, and people are struggling with how to really pull that together.
Jerry Nicholsberg, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're quite welcome.
Jerry Nicholsberg is a professor of economics with the UCLA Anderson Forecast. Renee Balsay, a writer with Law and Order, Criminal Intent and Law and Order series, will stay with us in the next half hour. If you'd like to join the conversation here on the writer's strike and the effects on the entertainment industry or your own TV viewing habits, you can join the conversation at 1-800-242-2828 or in the metro area at 651-227-6000. Or if you're online, simply go to minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question. But first, it's time for an update from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom with Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
Marianne, the latest wholesale price report is raising new concerns about whether the Fed will be able to help prop up the economy. Prices at the wholesale level rose 3.2% last month, the biggest increase in 34 years. It was a result of a record rise in wholesale gas prices. Meanwhile, retail sales rose by the largest amount in 6 months. A report on baseball steroids era is set to be released later today, and it's expected to expose a serious drug culture within the game. The probe, compiled by former Senator George Mitchell, will also name names. 60 to 80 players are expected to be on a list of those with connections to performance-enhancing drug use. Residents of the Northeast are facing a winter storm. It's already left hundreds of thousands of people in the Midwest in the dark. Some parts of the Northeast could get up to a foot of snow today. Meanwhile, heavy snow could also hit parts of Oklahoma tomorrow. More than 350,000 people in that state are still without power. The Golden Globe nominations are out, and the British historical romance Atonement is leading the pack with 7 nods, including Best Drama. Nominees for Best Comedy or Musical include Charlie Wilson's War and Hairspray. The awards will be handed out 1 month from today. A national media group says the St. Paul Police Department is abusing its power and flaunting freedom of the press. With its move to obtain a reporter's phone records, the police department got the cell phone records of KMSP-TV reporter Tom Lydon without giving the station the chance to fight the action in court. At issue was a 7-year-old arrest report Lydon obtained after the department refused to release it. Both the station and Ramsey County Sheriff Bob Fletcher say the document was public information. The Society of Professional Journalists says St. Paul Police should return Lydon's phone records and apologize. Windy, mostly cloudy around the state today. Some blowing snow and snow in northwestern Minnesota. A few flurries for the central and southern sections. Highs today, low 30s in the south. Teens in the northwest. Right now in the Twin Cities, 22 degrees under partly cloudy skies. It's 9:37. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor. A Prairie Home Companion comes back to Minnesota for winter at the Fitzgerald Theater. Friday night shows starting January 18th through the 15th of March. A lot of good seats available. All of our actors will be here, the Guys All-Star Shoe Band, and of course the Newsome Lake Wobegon. Tickets are on sale now through Ticketmaster at 651-989-5151 or visit them online at Ticketmaster.com. Hope to see you there.
Support for this program comes from Be Below, celebrating the holiday season with gifts, clothing, jewelry, stationery, and home accents. Delight in what is possible. Online at BeBelowShops.com and at any of Be Below's 4 metro locations.
We're back. You're listening to Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, sitting in today for host Carrie Miller. Be sure and stay tuned for our 10 o'clock hour. Coming up, we're going to be talking about girls and bullying. Maybe you saw the movie Mean Girls, or you've read some of the articles or books that sort of hype the idea, the notion that girls are just as bad bullies as boys are, but their ways of doing it are a little bit different. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk to a researcher at the University of Minnesota about the truth, telling the truth from fiction in terms of how girls bully. Her theory, for her research, shows that it actually starts from early childhood, these methods that girls use to be aggressive towards one another. And it's not like physical bullying. It's more of a psychological game. We're going to be looking at that coming up at the 10 o'clock hour. This hour, we are talking about the writer's strike and how it's affecting the entertainment industry, how it's affecting our own TV viewing. Joining us is Renee Balsay. He's the Emmy Award-winning writer and producer of the TV series Law and Order, also the executive producer and head writer for Law and Order Criminal Intent. And we have a full bank of phone lines, Renee, so we're going to go right back to the phones. We've got Robert on the line in Duluth. Robert, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. You know, I don't understand why these writers are on strike. What they're asking for is the equivalency of, because I own a Ford, every time that car gets bought or sold, the engineer who designed the engine gets a check. You get paid to provide a service. You write a show. You don't own the TV show. If you don't like the fact that producers make millions of dollars off of your efforts, then get more money up front. But you don't deserve to get paid in perpetuity for a service you provide.
Okay, Robert. Thanks for that. Renee, your reaction?
Well, first of all, taking the car analogy, the guy who invented the intermittent windshield wiper got $150 million for inventing it. So, he got a form of deferred payment.
That sounds like that's what Robert is asking for, is more money up front.
Well, no, he had to sue to get it. He got it, you know, 20 years after he invented the intermittent windshield wiper. The deal we made in recognition of the fact that, you know, people, you know, producers don't make all their money right away when they exploit a film or a TV show, is they pay us a portion of our compensation up front, and then as they exploit the show, and as, you know, whether if the show is successful and it gets rerun and shown in more in more venues or internationally, we get our deal with them is we get a share of the money, you know, they make off of that, and so it's a form of deferred compensation. So
I understand that concept, right. But you were saying earlier that there's a producer who just signed a contract. He's going to be making $50 million a year for the next 3 years. Sounds like he could put some money up front.
Well, you know, he's the head of a network, so okay. he's not taking that money and putting it into developing anything. He's putting it into his pockets. So, you know, the analogy the analogy is closer to someone who gets in business to build a building, a commercial property, and then you co-own the building. You know, you're the architect or the designer, and you're in business with the developer, and you build a building together, and then you share in the rental revenues of that building. That's the analogy. It's not the guy who buys, you know, who builds a car, and, you know, for Ford, and then every time that car gets resold, he gets a share of it. He gets his money up front. So that's, you know, the analogy doesn't hold.
Bobby in Hastings, Minnesota writes, isn't really the big problem the network channels going up against the shows on HBO, Showtime, etc.? Just take a look at the Golden Globe nominees.
Yeah, I don't really understand that question. I just want to point out just a local sort of connection. That one of the writers on Criminal Intent and on Law and Order, her name is Stephanie Sengupta. She is Tom Sengupta's daughter from Tom's Drugstore, one of your local celebrities in Minneapolis. Just wanted to point out that, you know, the writers are made up of, you know, people from all over the country, middle class people. So, you know, We don't all drive Jaguars or, you know, wear Gucci shoes or any of that stuff.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We've got Jenna on the line in St. Paul. Jenna.
Hello.
Hi.
I don't pretend to know what in heck is going to happen with any of this. I can only think that this is going to drive people to start reading, doing games, engaging activities in the family, maybe getting outside, getting off their butts, doing something productive for themselves.
So you think that this is just fine in your mind because people are going to stop watching TV?
Well, I think this is an upside. I don't watch TV, but I do watch a lot of people do nothing but TV. And I don't watch TV because I'm totally uninterested in most of the stuff that's on television. And so I've got other things to do, and maybe some people will finally say, oh, gee, there's a whole world out there. I don't need to sit staring at the boom box or whatever they call it.
All right. Thanks, Jenna.
Okay.
Renee, your thoughts on that? Maybe it's
well,
time that people...
It's certainly gotten us off our butts because we're now outside picketing and walking around in circles in the fresh air,
right.
Talking to other writers. So she's right.
But do you think that maybe there's a certain value to stimulating people into thinking about, you know, to breaking away from the regular ritual of television and getting people to think about what goes on behind it and what it could be that it isn't right now? It does seem like we're discussing the business of television and writing and the content a lot more these days because of the strike.
Well, it's certainly focusing on something that, you know, most people take for granted. And, you know, the point is well taken that, you know, when you read the statistics of, you know, children spending 4 to 6 hours a day watching television, it's kind of stunning. I mean, I don't watch that much television. Maybe I did when I was a little kid, but, you know, it's if people can, you know, get out and read, it is terrific. If it, you know, engenders other activities, that's great. unfortunately, I think what will happen is people are going to be spending, instead of less time watching television, they'll be spending more time playing video games, playing with their Xbox. They'll be spending more time on the Internet. If you watch how young people use the Internet, it's interesting. They're on the Internet. They're on Facebook. They're, at the same time, they're texting on their phone. They got four or five things going at the same time. I mean, their brains work a little differently than, certainly my brain.
Right. So they need to be watching 24 in order to get four different streams of information at one time.
Well, I don't know about 24. 24 was not going to be coming back this, right now anyways, because they've had other problems. But, yeah.
Let's go to Emily in Minneapolis. Emily, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. I'm really glad you guys are doing this show. I'm a big fan of Law & Order, and I'm also married to a Writers Guild member who we live in Falcon Heights. So he's one of the, I guess, two dozen writers on strike in the Twin Cities. And, it's not a big economic impact here in Minnesota, but it impacts my family. We're on the verge of losing our health insurance. And what I really appreciate is the local unions who are showing their support for the Writers Guild.
Excellent. And what is it that your husband is really hoping for to come out of this strike?
A fair deal with the multi-billion dollar corporations that hire him once in a while.
Mm-hmm. So he's not like he has a salaried position. He's just coming and going and based on the work.
He's developed series for television. He's had a couple movies produced. It's an up and down business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what people don't understand who have regular salaried.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Emily.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, that's the one thing. There's no guaranteed employment in this business. Most writers get one or two jobs a year. Months go by between jobs, and this deferred compensation called residuals, it really helps them bridge that gap. And certainly for Hollywood, it's a form of very cheap R&D. The perfect example is the one of Mark Cherry, the creator of Desperate Housewives. Well, he was unemployed. He was living on his residuals from writing Golden Girls, and he wrote the pilot for Desperate Housewives on speculation. That turned into a billion-dollar business for ABC. And, the residuals and deferred compensations are, like I said, it works to the benefit of the studios and the producers. And what they're suggesting is, if they get what they want in the future, when everything's over the internet, no one will be getting residuals. And I'll give you an example: Teamsters and IATSE each get about $300 million a year in residuals paid directly into the health and pension funds of those two unions. And if the producers get what they want, that $300 million a year is going to disappear. So you're going to get a lot of people with no pension, no health plan.
I've got Bob on the line in Worthington. Bob, welcome to Mid-Morning. What's your comment or question?
Good morning, Marianne.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning to you as well, Renee. I have a kind of a three-pronged question for Renee in that I'm trying to gauge effectively here anyway with a hard number as to exactly what the writers are looking for. Renee, you mentioned that the average writer makes somewhere in the range of $62,000 a year. I'd like to know what the median income of the writers are. And then secondly, and finally, with regards to the late-night talk show host, Leno, Letterman, I understand that they can find employment, they can go to the comedy club and do a shtick, and they're going to be fine. And I know that they're supporting the writers. I've read this in the newspaper. However, you had one a couple of weeks ago, Renee, that crossed the line and he claimed that I'm not affiliated with this union. I have no loyalty toward it. I'm kind of wondering what signal that sends to the writers. If you're going to have one talk show host, and I can't recall his name, maybe you could help me out with that, but he makes a dash across the line. I'm wondering if that sends a bad signal to the union overall, and I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks, Renee.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, first of all, I don't know the difference between average and medium income. I didn't take economics in college. So, In terms of numbers of what we're looking for, if we get what we want in terms of residuals for the internet and everything, basically our package represents $150 million in raises,
and that's spread out across 12,000
over 3 years. That's
okay.
$50 million a year, spread over 12,000 people.
Yeah,
and like I said, one executive, Les Moonves, signed a deal. He himself, by his own lonesome self, is going to make $50 million a year for the next 3 years. We're asking that same amount for 12,000 people, so it's pennies on the dollar. As far as the other part of that gentleman's question, the late night host's name was Carson Daly. He's not a member of the Writers Guild. He's not a writer, and that's certainly been painfully evident to anyone who's watched this show since he's gone back without writers. And he was the recipient of so much vitriol and people poking fun at him as a result, it's basically scared anybody else off from trying to do the same thing.
Well, didn't Ellen DeGeneres go back and say, I support the writers, and then she went on the air?
Yeah, maybe if the writers were all, little dogs, I think she might have, felt a little more.
Now be nice, Renee.
Yeah. people are going to do what they're going to do according to their own lights and their own conscience. No one else has really followed Carson Daly back to work. Ellen DeGeneres, continued. She's not using writers. Like I said, people are going to follow their own conscience. And so far, 99.9% of writers are, holding the line.
Let's go to Josh in Eden Prairie. Josh, welcome to Mid Morning.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm looking for a comment back. I guess my feeling is the public doesn't really have anything to lose right now. I'm, about 35 years old and have a lot of content available to me. I mean, when you look in 2007 at the history of just television, which is only a 50-year history, and now there's 300 channels that are on the air, and there's box sets of everything out, I could literally never have new content developed again for the duration of my life and still see original programming.
Interesting.
Something that I've never seen before. That's never really existed before in the history of man until the last, decade.
Mm-hmm.
I can download movies onto my Xbox. I can download movies onto my TiVo from Amazon. I can download programming onto my telephone. I can watch it on,
Mm-hmm.
There's so much girth of stuff out there that literally if the public just says, all right, look, there's nothing but reruns and reality TV on right now. Let's look somewhere else. I don't think anybody but the writers and the major networks, they're the ones that really have something to lose from all this.
Okay.
And so I guess I just appreciate some commentary on that.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
Yeah.
Renee?
Well, of course, there's 300 channels, and, I don't know if some of them are, channels devoted to playing checkers, or so you could certainly watch endless games of checkers or poker, or
you could also watch Masterpiece Theater.
You could watch reruns of Masterpiece Theater. There are probably 2 million people out in the country who will watch reruns of Masterpiece Theater. The point is well taken. The public at large, they're insatiable. They do want new content. There is, scripted programming there's a reason why advertisers seek to advertise on scripted programming, because that gets the largest audience, the highest quality audience, and a consistent audience. So, I guess we're going to find out, what the appetite is for, the Golf Classic Network, or in the months to come.
Well, it does speak to this notion, though, that, you know, Josh is saying he can go back and look at some great classics. He can just go through and run through all of the classics and great content that's been out there in the past, and he's probably set and for the end of his life. So it sounds like
I hope he keeps, you know, I hope he goes back and watches reruns and downloads of, you know, Law and Order, Criminal Intent, and
which
Law
would,
and Order. That'll be great for me.
And it'd keep, yeah, for a couple of years, that would keep him going. So,
yeah, so.
But the thing, doesn't that speak to what now there's a demand that if you're going to really come up with something new, it better be good. And because it's now, it's not just fighting against all the other stuff that's on the air. It's fighting against everything else that people can download in one of 10 different ways and watch that they enjoyed in the past or have never seen, but they've heard as a classic.
Well, sure. I mean, you're always competing against, you know, what you've made, and, you know, it's sort of, you're competing against history in a way. And, you know, no one sets out to make bad movies or bad TV shows. The writers live in the same world as everybody else. They're watching, you know, the same shows. They know what the quality is. They know when the bar gets raised, and everyone is always trying to, you know, meet or surpass that bar. You know, and I think there's always going to be a thirst also for new content. I mean, it's like saying, well, we have all the art now that we can stand. We can go back and look at Rembrandts and, you know, Greek sculpture. So what do we need all this new contemporary art? They could all, you know, stop painting and we don't care. Well, the art market would collapse,
mm-hmm.
first of all. And also collectors, you know, people want the newest thing. That's part of human nature. They want it, you know, they want to see the newest thing. They want to be part of the buzz of what's happening now. So
Jessica in Minneapolis writes, I'm a huge labor booster, but really miss The Daily Show, etc. Are you worried about backlash even from your supporters? I'm getting sick of it.
Well, you know, like I said, we writers have stayed at the negotiating table. We have not broken off negotiations. We want this strike to end. And, you know, we want it to end with a fair deal, a deal, you know, that a pundit said, you know, the best deal that's going to be made is the one that's going to make both sides unhappy. So, you know, we're looking for, you know, that fair deal. So we have not left the negotiating table. We don't like being on strike, you know, and, you know, if anybody has a beef with anybody, it should be with the AMPTP. They're the ones who now twice have left, broken off negotiations.
We've just got a minute or two left here, and Genevieve in Minneapolis writes, which TV shows does Renee think are the best written, excluding the ones he works for, of course?
Well, that's a really unfair question. There's a lot of TV shows that I, you know, that I enjoy. The caveat being, though, you know, that when I'm working, you know, I work pretty hard, and I don't really have time to watch, you know, TV shows from... I don't really watch that much TV, though I do watch The Daily Show, so and The Colbert Report. I'll admit to that.
Okay, so Daily Show, Colbert Report, you think they're pretty well written?
I think they're pretty brilliant.
Any other series out there, either on cable or on network TV, that just you hear a lot of buzz about?
Oh God, I'm gonna catch heck for. You know, for venture.
Go for it.
Well, you know, so, look, I've enjoyed The Sopranos. I really like Dexter, you know, so it's, you know, those are the ones that, you know, because I got the DVDs of. I've got other DVDs I'm sure I'll have time to get to now, The Wire and, you know, the series like those.
So you're doing some catching up right now.
I'm going to be doing a lot of catching up and a lot of walking in circles.
Yeah. All right. Renee Balsay, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you, Marianne.
Renee Balsay is the Emmy Award-winning writer and producer of the TV series Law and Order. He's also the executive producer and head writer for Law and Order, Criminal Intent. If you missed any of this hour, you can always find us on the web archives, minnesotapublicradio.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.